Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Mud Toe at Midnight. I am your host, Mud Toe Sasquatch. I have played my flute and I have offered sacred fire in the four directions. Please join me in sacred ceremony. I speak as spirit moves me to speak, and I invite you to do the same by calling me at 646-595-3440. And now, Mud Toe at Midnight.
Yes, sir. It is Mud Toe Sasquatch here on my radio show, Mud Toe at Midnight. I have no idea what accent this is supposed to be. Probably something terribly inappropriate. Don't mean it to be. Just I prepare nothing for this show, so I don't know when it's time for me to start talking, I just start talking. And sometimes what I say is not something that's not something that's terribly fascinating, I guess. So I'll start off talking in a funny accent, which is good while it lasts, I suppose. But anyway, I am Mud Toe. Thank you for listening to my show this evening. I had, I mentioned in the open, which, as I say every time I mention the open, that it's dreadfully out of date. But and one of the things that's out of date about it is that I don't put up the sacred smoke where I am now, or the sacred fire, because I'm habitating my parents' house until I can acquire new accommodations in my large city in the Midwest. And so it not being my house, I just don't light up the sage or the incense or whatever anytime I feel like it. And the little bit, not that I am ashamed of my faith at all, it does take some effort and there can be some conflict generated by, I envision there could be some conflicts generated by questions, can I light up this incense? She'll want to know why, I have to tell her why, and she'll say, why are you doing that? Couldn't you light up the incense for Jesus, and all that stuff. So anyway, long story short, too late, I don't actually light up the incense or the sage anymore. I have a couple of fake candles that I acquired in case I know they were like sort of stocking stuffers in case I need to fill in when somebody perhaps came up at the last minute and I didn't know that I needed to get a present for them. These incredibly cheap LED candles, but the candle part isn't the fascinating part. It's underneath it flashes in colors, the LED-type colors. And then when I first got them, it flashed in four colors. It did orange, green, blue, and red, and then it went back to orange. I had them for a couple of days and lost all of the colors except the orange. So it goes orange, and then it goes like this sort of mishmash, something in between what were the ones I said, green, blue, and red. I don't think there's any red left in anymore. Just a grayish green. Kind of looks like the uniforms of the old Star Trek. The one with Jeffrey Hunter that didn't get picked up, if any of you is nerdy enough like me to remember that. So anyway, that's become my sacred fire for the moment. I just click one of those on and it just flickers away. Technology to the rescue once again. That whole story could have been told as I have this fake candle that I use instead of the sage. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? I had a little work this week. I know I promised, if any of you read my Facebook posting, I did promise to talk about the big story du jour. A little hint there if you didn't see my Facebook posting. And I will. I promise I will, although I don't really want to, but I will. But I'm going to say a bunch of other stuff first. And maybe I'll forget. No, I won't forget. I promise I won't forget. I worked this week, which is fun because I hadn't worked for over a month. I went out with this outfit that has designed a wonderful medical device, and I'm the guy that they don't test it on me. What they do is we go out to hospitals, and they train people how to use it. And so I get to lay down on a gurney, and they show the trainer shows them how the thing is supposed to be put on, and then the other person works with it until they know how to put it on. So it's actually more of a direct medical training field that I found myself in. Usually I'm just interacting with medical students, and I have a script that I go by, and they ask me questions, and I answer according to my script, and then the students are supposed to be able to determine certain information from the information that I've given them. If they ask the correct questions and they follow the correct pathways, then they get theoretically to the correct diagnosis. So useful, very useful. I enjoy doing it. But this other thing that I do is much more direct. Someone in the hospital actually putting something on me and learning how to use this new piece of equipment. It's not terribly comfortable. I'm not really shy in any way. But the problem is that they stick this thing on me with tape, and then they got to rip it off. And the trainer sticks it on, rips it off once, but the person being trained, sometimes they had got to do it four or five times. And then another person comes in. And I got up this morning, went to the bathroom, and happened to catch a sight of my reflection in the mirror, which I try never to do. But I did, and you can see just perfect red marks where every place where that thing attached to my chest. It's like, the last person who did the training wouldn't have had to have figured out anything out. The markings were all already there for them. The other thing I wanted to say about that particular, I know actually there are two. Well, only one about the place. The other thing about the place that was kind of fun, not fun at all, but fun. The place where they had us, we didn't know this until just before we were about to leave. And I didn't know such a thing existed. But they called it the viewing room. And this is in the emergency department. And the viewing room in the emergency department is the place where they put the people who die in the emergency department while they're waiting for the medical examiner or the funeral director to come and pick them up, so that they're out of the way, you understand, and that the any relatives or anything can go to see them, and they're also out of the way. You know, they're not there weeping and wailing while other people are in emergency trying to get cured. So obviously they didn't have any such business that day. I would hope they don't have very much at any time. It's just the tiniest bit distressing that they have enough of it that they do have to have a separate room for it. Nice little room. A little bit cramped, but I guess the usual occupants of the room really wouldn't mind about that, would he? So, anyway, there was that. And there's also got a chance, I have another way I want to go. I rode there and back 2 days, yesterday and the day before, with the gentleman behind Muckety-Muck in the sales department of the company. And it was very nostalgic for me because when I was young, the first job I had actually was riding around the country with the high Mucky Muck salespeople. And I was sort of their sidekick. You know, they would go to do the selling. And I was the engineer. I would just get an odd question here and there, and I'd make a note. And I'd look at things, you know, stuff was being tested. Our stuff in there was new, and I'd look and see how it was doing. And sometimes I got to do 24-hour process monitoring, which was fun. As a young guy, I got to do the late shift usually. But it was nostalgic to be with him because he had exactly the same personality as I remember. All the salesmen I knew had this same very driven, very, they talk over you. They have, they try to anticipate all the questions. They already have all the answers. If they don't, then they can get them. In fact, they'll have the answers probably before you finish asking the question. Much easier for them now with smartphones and whatnot. It's kind of a, I was going to say annoying type A personality. Type A personality wouldn't be annoying per se. It's just I find it annoying. A little. Not a lot. Not 100% annoying. It can be, you know, when somebody, especially, well, I'll tell you, it was because he kind of, he was kind of, I won't say nasty. It was, didn't go that far. The trainer, the person who was showing the other person people how to do this, was a nurse. And a very professional person, a very highly trained person. And this salesman was constantly questioning her. Now, it's true he knows more about the product than she does because he's been working for the company longer, and he's been, you know, working, you know, taking it to places and testing it and so forth, and she's only started doing this very recently. You know, there's ways to handle that, especially when you're in front of other people. So I'm taking this, and first of all, I'm practicing my own sort of self-containment and meditation skills to not jump up and try and defend the woman, because she was well able to defend herself. She didn't need defending by me. So it's a matter of mind my own business, but also step up and listen to what was happening, observe what was happening, and see if I could learn something. I mean, obviously there's a niche for that sort of person and that sort of personality in our society because they're so commonly successful. People like, and I wonder if it's just, you know, because the people higher up like these people who just work themselves to death. You know, he would have worked, he would have stayed there. We were there 12 hours. He would have stayed 16 if there had been any reason to, if there had been any other people to train. Anyway, and I got paid for everything I did, and I'm sure that the nurse got paid for everything she did. But it's sort of the attitude that the job comes first. The job always comes first, because that's what you're trying to do. That's your identity. Is what you do is your identity. You know, it's in what play is that? The line is, a man is his job. Jack Lemmon delivers it, and it is Glengarry Glen Ross, I believe. I think. Anyway, you know, that to believe a man is his job. And someone who would say, you know, can we stop and eat? You know, we didn't take any meal breaks. I knew better the end of the second day to bring snacks with me, which was, you know, fully permitted. Oh, sure, have a snack. You know, I mean, interesting to know that before. Anyway, again, I'm sitting here on the internet radio talking, seeming to talk down the company that is giving me some employment. I don't talk them down at all. They make a hell of a product, and he is a hell of a guy. I'm just pointing out that he has that salesman personality, that just we call them the super salesmen. This is to go out and they they're going to conquer the world, and they're going to do it today. And the other side applies sort of with equal force, too. If something, anything bad that happens, and we had a setback, we had a pretty major setback. There was a problem. And it goes the other way, you know, it's a disaster. Every problem that happens is a disaster. It was a problem. It was a serious problem. But it was workable. It was savable, salvageable, and we did very well. By the end of the day, we had it completely turned around, and I'm not going to claim any credit for that. I was just laying there, but it's kind of, I wanted to, and I had to, restrain myself isn't the right word. I had to stop myself from saying, now see, you know, wouldn't you talk kind of silly that all that fuss you made this morning? Because that would have done absolutely no good. And I am talking about his livelihood. I'm talking about what he does for a living and how he's going to make his reputation at this company and go on maybe for years to come. And it's a, a misstep at this point in the process could very well have a negative impact on that going forward for quite some time. So I feel that I need to be more careful in deciding that things are silly and that people are silly. Because everybody's coming from their own place. It's a place that I cannot possibly understand. I can observe it if I take the trouble to do so. But I will never know where it is he's coming from. And what it is that drives his ideas of what are important, what is important and what is not. So I sit back, I listen, I learn. And that's what I can take away from this. So I didn't say it was going to be earth-shattering. I didn't say I was going to be moving mountains. Nor did I. I said it was something to learn, and I did learn something, I think. That's what it was. Okay, I am going to share with you. This is from a book of readings. These are 12-step readings. I promise I won't let it get too heavy. And this book was given to me when I first achieved 1 year of sobriety by some friends in the fellowship. The book is called Walk in Dry Places. And it's sort of the answer to the question, how do you maintain long-term sobriety? And one of the things that you do is you just stay away from people, places, things that might tend to push you away from your sobriety, either through association or through triggers or however it happens for you. Then perhaps the best way, especially if you don't have 20 years in, if you've got 1 year in, maybe the best way is to just eschew those places and people and situations that tend to be bothersome, I'll say, for me. And I found that idea very valuable. I haven't always been able to stick to it, but it is there. So I have this book, Walk in Dry Places. If you're not familiar with the format of this, is a daily devotional reading. And it's just one reading, one page for every day of the year, and just an idea for that day. So this was the idea for January the 9th, and it's called Coming to Grips with Fear. Fear, a universal human emotion, strikes each of us in different ways. The brave parachute jumper might be afraid of public speaking. The brilliant orator might have a fear of flying. Alcoholic drinking is partly an attempt to cope with the feelings of fear. The recovering person, now having no drug, must face fear by using the tools of the program. The sober way to deal with the fear is to admit that one has fears, to discuss them with a sponsor or another understanding person, to seek the help of one's higher power in living with fear or having it removed. When we share our experience with fear, we have different kinds of stories. One person may declare that fear was completely removed by prayer. Another person who prayed with what seemed to be the same degree of sincerity may still be troubled by occasional fears. We cannot know exactly how the program will help each person cope with fear, but we can be confident that it will work for all of us. We have met fear successfully when we continue to stay sober and meet our responsibilities in all sorts of threatening situations. I will not let fear keep me from any good thing today. My higher power can see me through any difficult or threatening situation. And I think that's, obviously we can all find a way to apply that in our different ways. I think one that probably jumps off the page at just about everybody is what's been going on over in France in the past couple of days. And I've been hearing about this sitting in the car on the way to my job, listening to it on CNN because my dude has the television on his radio for some reason. It's from Sirius. It comes in through Sirius XM. He likes to listen to CNN. And the situation from a number of different angles is I find it to be very fear-based. Particularly, well, I can't speak obviously for an Al-Qaeda person or for whomever it was who was behind this ultimately behind it. I know there's fear coming from the Western side of it, from our side of it. It's the fear that our control of the world continues to slip away from us, and there just doesn't seem to be anything that we can do about it because the terrorists just keep appearing. And I was listening to this, and it was interesting because I'm listening to CNN without the benefit of seeing pictures or faces of any kind. I'm just hearing voices and words and tone of voices. I'm hearing they're bringing in these experts saying, you know, why didn't they do this? Why didn't they do that? Why weren't these people kept on a watch list? And it comes down to what's always said in these situations. And this is not a new situation. I mean, 200 years ago, closer to 250 now, the roles were reversed. It was the American patriots, the American revolutionaries, the Minutemen, who took on the world's biggest empire, the British Empire. And they did it not by standing in a straight line and getting shot down. They did it by hiding behind the rocks and the trees and the bushes and then picking them off one by one, and the Brits called them cowards for it. Same strategy is now... It comes up any time there is a sort of an ideology, a tenacious ideology that simply does not have the power to prevail against the dominant social ideology. And I'm not going to place values obviously the people who did what they did in France. It's a horrible thing. They shouldn't have done it. It's nonsensical that we actually have to say those things. Then when I start to talk about what's happened and try to analyze what's happened, I could stand here and be accused by someone of saying, well, you're supporting their position. You're supporting what they did. I am not in any way supporting what the terrorists did. It's not right. It's not justified in any way. So what I'm saying is a tactic was selected because they couldn't stand up in a straight line and let the Americans, the Europeans, the Westerners shoot them down. Not if they wanted to survive. So they selected a different tactic. It's a tactic the Minutemen used in the American Revolution. It's a tactic used by the Irish Republican Army when they were fighting the Brits for, 40, 50 years? A bunch of guys with short arms against one of the biggest armies, one of the best equipped armies, an army that we helped to equip. And they, I don't want to use words like won because won is value laden. The IRA is still there. The Brits never defeated them. Look also at the Palestinians and the Israelis. That's been going on for how long now? 60 years, almost 65 years. The Israelis, with the backing of, again, the United States, all the material, all the equipment, all the training that we can possibly give them, and they don't have the compunctions. Again, I don't want to say now you're speaking out against the Israelis. It is a fact that the Israelis aren't as shy or haven't in the past been as shy about using their hardware as, say, the Americans have. And they're not shy about leaving their borders and chasing people into other countries. So, but it, even given all of that, 65 years, they still have not eradicated the Palestinians. The United States gets it turned around on them when we go into Vietnam. Between the French and the USA in Vietnam, between the Viet Minh facing the French, the Viet Cong facing the United States, something like 30 years, if I have my calculations right, couldn't wipe them out. Vastly superior numbers, vastly superior technology. We'd like to think vastly superior tactics and command and control. Couldn't do it. Left the country in 1975, Viet Cong still firmly in control. the forces that were behind the Viet Cong run Vietnam to this day. I had another example I was going to use. Maybe it was Al Qaeda, probably Al Qaeda, and ISIS after them. You say, well, we mentioned, and what's happening? That's where I started this point. This is the point I'd started, and I got away from it. I forgot it actually. I was listening to these voices and the sort of the desperation I was hearing in people's voices. We have to do this. We must do this. The idea is that all that's missing is we just haven't used enough force. Okay? If we only used more force, ISIS, we could eradicate them. If we only had less, you know, compunction for protecting the rights of innocent people. Someone actually suggested, so they have a, you know, a, what they call it, a no-fly list, and this was led to these people knowing that they went to Syria, I think it was Syria, yes. And they said, we have to, but there are protections in Europe. You can't, they can't put you on one of these lists unless they have some reason to believe, you know, probable cause is what we call it in the States. He says, we have to let that go, he said, this person. We have to be more vigilant. We have to be stronger. And I find that idea very disturbing, that we want to, as a people who value freedom, we're willing to trade that away for what we imagine to be security. But what is really beating people down? And we have a group of people that are acting in a criminal way, and that needs to be stopped. To me, the first and most important step would be to identify the people who are paying for ISIS, who are paying for Al Qaeda, who are paying for dudes to have automatic rifles that you can't get in France, to have those bulletproof vests. Where did they come from? Those guys, they didn't have enough money to buy gas. Of course, they didn't buy them. Who bought them for them? Find out who is paying it and, you know, pay those people a visit. Now, that isn't happening, and I think I know why. I'm hesitant to say it, because if I'm right, I don't know if I want this in my voice out over the airwaves where people could say, oh, there's that asshole. I think the reason is that the people who are paying for the terrorist activity are highly placed people in the economic and political elite, and the Western democracies, including the United States, either can't oppose them or won't oppose them, because it would disrupt economic activity and make wealthy people upset. I think it almost has to have something to do with petroleum. Almost has to have something to do with the supply of oil in the world, that the fear is that if they went after the people who are paying to supply the terrorists, that the supply of petroleum would somehow be disrupted by them, or they're actually the people who are dealing it, or something along those lines. So there's your crazy conspiracy theory mud toe for today. I try not to let them out, only very occasionally. It seemed an opportune time. So anyway, we are at the end of today's program. Thank you for tuning in. Sorry I wasn't here last week. I broke a tooth, and I absolutely could not speak. I would have been fussless. You know, you wouldn't have gotten anything out of it. Thanks for coming back this week. Please come back next week for a wonderful new program. Hopefully more happy and uplifting than this week's. Until then, have a wonderful week, and I will see you next week. Goodbye.